I remember going around and anesthesiologists would routinely say, "I don't need this. I know when my patients are hypoxic." And in the meanwhile, Barbara Walters had just done a special on thousands of anesthetic mishaps every year.
David Goodman helped develop the pulse oximeter, perhaps the most ubiquitous medical device, before he stepped foot in medical school 26 years ago and joined a legendary anatomy team. But what has he done lately? Join us right now as we learn what David, you'll find him in the dictionary under Mensch, has been up to.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health. I'm Lisa Soonan.
And I'm David Chewitz.
David Goodman is a remarkably successful serial entrepreneur who's been involved in a range of companies generally focused on the application of medical devices to health and wellness. He also maintains a general medical practice and sees patients from the community on the weekend. Yes, he's really the complete package. However, success for David was neither immediate nor inevitable. Like Mark Zuckerberg, David grew up the son of a dentist in a middle-class Jewish community and always aspired to be a doctor. Can you take it from there, David?
I can, David.
Great to see you, David. I got to stop here. What was legendary about the anatomy on this team? That's what I want to know.
We graduated.
I was going to say that we passed. That was what was legendary.
We had the nicest professor who was like, "Oh, you're solidly on to like 50% of the material."
Excellent.
It's like we graduated. We promised never to go.
It was
to rely on anatomy again.
It was truly a remarkable class. Actually, the professor was a story in and of himself.
Sort of like an Indiana Jones guy, for real.
Yeah. Really.
Elaborate.
Well, I mean, we would come in the class
Farish
in the
Jenkins.
Morning. Farish A. Jenkins, who was the Alexander Agassiz Professor of Invertebrate Paleontology at Harvard University. And was a professor of anatomy at Harvard Medical School, but he only taught the HST students, which was the Harvard MIT program.
Nerds.
And every morning, definitely nerds, every morning when we would come into lecture, there would be six panels of whiteboard festooned with unbelievably ornate and anatomical drawings in full color. And at the end of the-
Hand-drawn each time.
And
wow.
Hand-drawn each time.
By him?
By him. Every lecture had beautiful artwork on the chalk, on the whiteboard.
Amazing.
It was amazing.
And when he wasn't doing it, he was off in Antarctica or in, you know. It's
he was the co-discoverer, actually, of the missing link.
Was he on your anatomy team?
He was. Actually, that could have been our fourth anatomy partner. So
you only went to medical school 16 years ago?
Actually, thank you, David. You've taken away a few years of my life. But no, I went to in 89, graduated in 93. So 22 years ago, I graduated.
I was trying to take away some years.
Yeah, that's all right. I'm very proud of my silver hair and scars from both business and family. And I think that was what was legendary. I mean, you asked a question about
what made you become a doctor?
What made me become a doctor? And I think there are two words, which is Dr. Welby. You know, which was growing up, I only wanted to be like Dr. Welby.
Yeah.
That was my goal. That was the only thing I wanted to do. And when I got to college, I thought, well, you know, one way to differentiate myself from the sea of pre-meds that were in front of me at Penn was to do something a little different. So I said, you know what, I think I'm going to go into bioengineering. Not knowing anything about bioengineering and not reading the fine print that engineering is actually kind of difficult.
Yeah, there's math. I hear there's math involved.
Yeah, there's math. There's a lot of math. And there's physical chemistry and a lot of courses that, let's just say, didn't treat me very well. And so my undergraduate experience was great. I played lightweight football, although I wouldn't make the weight right now, but I played lightweight football in college. I was a fraternity brother.
What position did you play?
I played tight end.
Nice.
Yeah. And I didn't get to play very much, but I did make the team, and I did make 158-pound weight limit every game 2 days before the game. Now I don't think I can make 158 pounds even if you cut off both my legs. But, but that's another topical.
No, you're looking good, Dave.
So anyway, it didn't work out.
The
football career didn't work out, and then when it came time to apply
not
to medical
school. Not a lot of
Jewish
doctors football go on to football
there are
careers.
There are not a lot of Jewish football players. A lot of few Jewish team owners, and I think there's probably a message in that, which is, you know, Jews typically aren't big enough to play football. In fact, at my high school, I went to Bronx Science in New York. We didn't have 11 kids that were big enough to play football, so we didn't have a football team, but we had a hell of a chess team.
You got a foosball team instead.
A foosball, chess, math, you name it. Anyway.
Dynamite mathletes.
Mathletes. And so when it came time to apply to med school, I think that's when my academic record came home to roost. And not only did I not get into medical school, but I didn't get a single interview, which was actually devastating. I mean, that was by far and away the biggest disappointment in my life. I mean, you know, like most of us, we grew up with fortunately, relatively few traumatic episodes. You know, I was very fortunate for that. That was a complete crush. I mean, I had no plan B at that time. I mean, I really had just assumed that I was going to go to med school, you know, go find a community just like Dr. Welby, be the town bedrock, and be a primary care doctor, be a solid contributor, and save a lot of lives. And that didn't work out. And I just didn't know what else to do. And so I thought about it, and I said, you know what, maybe I'll just go to grad school. And grad school was, and I, fortunately, my record was good enough to get into Penn. So I was a bioengineering graduate student at Penn. And I was very fortunate to wind up in the lab of a professor of anesthesiology over at Children's Hospital.
And CHOP.
At CHOP, yeah, which is a great place. And the anesthesia department, as it turns out, is a wonderful place if you're a geek. And my professor, or my thesis advisor, actually was an aerospace engineer, undergraduate at MIT, Harvard Medical School, not HST, though. And I gave him a bunch of grief about that later on in life. But he was an anesthesia professor and an engineer, and we did a project together. He put me on a project analyzing pressure waveforms in critically ill children. And so that was my first real exposure to bioengineering, and I loved it. In fact, I learned how to program on an Apple II, which is crazy because I was listening this morning. Somebody threw out an Apple I computer in their garage, and it was sold for like $250,000. And I'm thinking, why didn't I save those old relics? But
Huh. So you think medicine was done for you at that point?
I thought that what I could do is I could buff up my academic record and then reapply. And I buffed up my academic record a little. And my MCAT scores were a little better. And it was enough to just get me one interview the second time I applied. And my interview was at Penn, and I remember the director of admissions saying maybe I should consider a career as a paramedic and not as a doctor. And I thought, you know, I had some thoughts that I won't share, but let's just say that was not what I was hoping to hear. And of course, I got rejected at Penn. And at that point, I realized I had to get a job. And during my tenure at CHOP in David Swedlow's lab, the professor that I was working for, one of the research nurses married one of the fellows, and they moved to the Bay Area, and they moved to a little townhouse in Alameda. And I called Sandy and said, Sandy, I'm looking for a job, thinking that I could get a job in a biomedical engineering position in a hospital. And the next thing I know, I get this random call for some guy who said his name was Jim Kornman, who was starting a company called Nelcor, that they were doing this thing called a pulse oximeter, that they were going to raise venture capital. They were going to build a $100 million company. They couldn't pay me very much if they hired me, but they, you know, if I got hired, they might give me some stock options. So as I was telling David previously, when I was growing up, I grew up in a middle-class Jewish neighborhood, and you were either, the only careers that I was aware of was, you know, you're a doctor, a dentist, a lawyer, an accountant, or a criminal.
What about a mortician?
Or a mortician, exactly. I mean, you know,
his own lines.
Business was not, you know, I knew nobody who was in business, and I didn't know what a $100 million company was, but I did know that from the work that I was doing as a blood gas tech, that if they could do something in the way of measuring oxygen non-invasively, that could be a big deal. So I actually flew myself out to California on my own nickel, and those cheapskates said fine. And I met with the founding team in Nelcor in an office probably not much bigger than this. And there were basically, we sat around a table about this size with the four founders of Nelcor. And I spent a whole day with them, and they made me do a chalk talk about my research at CHOP. And at the end of that interview, they said that they really liked me and they were going to hire me. And I said, well, you can't do this without me, because at that point I realized that the only job offers that I had gotten up until that point were, one was from defense contractor, and they said they could put me on a medical project, but then after that they couldn't guarantee I wouldn't be working on radar systems, and a big medical company in Orange County. So anyhow.
So, you know, you told your story of your life's greatest disappointment. Mine was, I went through 6 rounds of interviews at Nalcor, and at the last one, I didn't get hired.
Oh, no!
And I was devastated. I was so devastated by it. I remember it so distinctly, and I...
What schmucks.
I know, right?
It was their loss.
It was.
So that's so interesting. I mean, because the medical device world was so... had so much promise then, right?
It
was just the beginning. It was growing phenomenally. It had, you know, a 30-year run, and then it just seemed to have, now it's just sort of hit a wall.
Well, it was the 80s, you know, and those are the heady times for medical devices.
Yeah.
I mean, those are the big, you know, the ultrasound companies, all the therapeutic medical devices, all the patient monitoring systems.
Yep.
I mean, there was a lot of venture capital, there was a lot of excitement, and there were a lot of spinoffs. So a lot of alumni from Nalcor and companies went off to do other things.
Yep.
And so I was fortunate. I mean, there was nothing about what I had done that I would say, you know what, I planned to get from Riverdale in the Bronx to Penn to the Bay Area to get to Nalcor.
And then when you were at Nalcor, so the device that, maybe just to describe the device, if people aren't familiar with it, this is a little clip that now is in everywhere, in every hospital and every clinic, every doctor's office. You clip it on your finger and it figures out what your oxygen saturation is. And it's sort of relatively important. And I remember
the
David.
Whole oxygen thing. It's,
yeah, yeah.
It's on the rise.
Yeah, Dave had the nicest apartment in medical school. So
it was a but what's interesting about that and what it was an incredible lesson was when I started at Nalcor, anesthesiologists didn't know about pulse oximetry. There was no easy way to monitor blood oxygen non-invasively. And I remembered, because I'd never told you this, but I actually sold the first Nalcor pulse oximeter up at Toronto SickKids. And I remembered going around, and anesthesiologists would routinely say, I don't need this. I know when my patients are hypoxic. And in the meanwhile, Barbara Walters had just done a special on ABC about, you know, anesthesiologists basically killing thousands of people, or there were thousands of anesthetic mishaps every year. So there was really a disconnect that I saw very powerfully demonstrated with Nalcor, which was that if you really understand your market, you understand the problem, then even if your customers don't fully understand it, that you can still develop a solution if you have the right solution and you are really solving an important problem.
But you have to sell it to somebody.
You have to sell.
This is the Steve Jobs way, right? Is you anticipate the problem before
exactly.
The customer knows it's there.
Well, and I have to say that Nalcor really nailed the product design. I mean, there were other oximetry type devices on the market, really clunky earpiece design, and Nalcor, the founding team in Nalcor included an anesthesiologist who also was an engineer and a physiologist and your typical.
Overachiever, Dave, was that the word you were looking for?
Overachiever, but he was also my mentor, and he's still my hero in many ways. And he really understood the problem in the operating room. And so between Bill New, who is the NE of Nalcor, and Jack Lloyd, the LL of Nalcor, they really put together a product that met that need in the operating room. And initially, they sold it as an oxygen monitor, you know, a monitor to help you know where your patient's oxygenation was. And that was a complete flop. I mean, doctors didn't get that. And they changed their marketing pitch just a little bit, which is, it's not an oxygen monitor, it's a hypoximeter, and it'll basically keep your butt out of a courtroom because you will now know where your patient's oxygen is before they run out and something bad happens to them. And after that, you know, things started to take off a little bit.
Scare tactic marketing.
And then virtually, I would say one by one, every hospital that, you know, and it's sad because sometimes innovations that are safety oriented don't get adopted until disaster strikes. And we see this in the airline industry, and healthcare is no different. And hospital, after they suffered, you know, what in 99.99% of the time was a preventable death or a, you know, a disaster related to oxygenation, either in the ICU or in the OR, those hospitals tended to convert to customer status pretty quickly.
What's the comparable today? What's the thing that's killing lots of patients in hospitals that they haven't solved for yet?
Doctors.
I could do the world some good, get rid of both you guys
Exactly. You know, I think probably the thing that's killing people is they're spending too much time in hospitals.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not for lack of caring. It seems I continue to be amazed, and I'm sure you are too, is, you know, being so savvy about healthcare, that we go into the healthcare system and there are some elements of it that are unbelievably high tech. Like, I had an MRI on my knee this morning, and I'm looking at this incredible piece of hardware called an MRI scanner. And at the same time, you know, we can't communicate basic information across healthcare providers.
Did they give you your CD when you were done?
They did. I had to pay $10 for it, but I got it. And I'm thinking to myself, that's just... If only there was a cloud. if only we could get rid of HIPAA. But that's the subject of another...
podcast.
Because that's probably the subject of another podcast. But anyway, so that era in Nellcor was transformative for me in so many ways. I mean, not only did I realize that engineering was actually pretty cool, but I also realized that I actually was pretty darn good at it. And I just never appreciated the fact that I came from a family with engineering because my dad was a dentist. And I never associated dentistry with engineering. But of course, it is. It's all about engineering.
It is, yeah.
And I never appreciated that when he was alive. And it was really my career at Nellcor that allowed me one last opportunity to think about going back to med school.
So with the development of the Nellcor, of the pulse oximeter in your pocket, so to speak, or on your finger, what happened when you applied to medical school the third time? Tell the nice folks.
Third time's a charm.
Third time is a charm. Well, I mean, I was...
Your mother was finally proud of you?
My mother was finally proud of me, and my father at that point had passed away. And I think even my dad, you know, who would have said, you know, I'm glad you got into medical school, never would have thought how things turned out. But, you know, it did. I think you know, as I like to point out, you know, at that point I had 14 or 15 patents either issued or pending. And that kind of mitigated the D that I got in physics in college. But not at UCSF, interestingly enough. I got enormous amounts of grief about my grades at UCSF during my interview there. And at Harvard, you know, I had my interview
at
Harvard.
They had lower standards at Harvard.
They had lower standards, or they were more interested in people that had kind of quirky career trajectories. And I remember that the group that I had spoken with were really interested about the work that I was doing in fetal oximetry and pulse oximetry and this incredible career that I had, which was really, you know, life-changing in so many ways for me. And at the end, kind of on my way out, it was Dan Shannon, actually.
Yeah, David, wonderful, wonderful human being. One of the most talk about great
Yeah, he
beings.
Was a mensch, who said to me on the way out in passing, so tell me, why were you a screw-up in college? And it was like that was kind of like they, you know, they had to close the loop on it, but they seemed to be really interested in the right things, and I was fortunate that this HST program existed, because that was actually where I got in.
And then even once you were in medical school, one of the things that struck me was we were sitting in the same class, actually taught by the guy who now is the editor of the New England Journal, right?
Jeff Drazen.
The cast of thousands, but he was one of the key instructors. So, you know, we go out of the class and it's like, you know, I hopefully retain something on my way to the next thing. He had the same lecture, like one of those things where, like, you know, what happened to the guy who was sitting next to Steve Jobs, right? Like, that was me. So it's like, oh, okay, you know, this is how the lungs work. Meanwhile, this guy hatches in class this idea for a whole new company. Do you want to?
So it was Jeff Drazen, he's a pulmonologist, also, and this was well before he was at the New England Journal, was and still teaches, by the way, the same physiology class. So he proudly wears his HST sweatshirt, even though he didn't go there. He just got into the standard Harvard program.
I see.
But so he
this
was
is
giving
killing a, Lisa.
Look at guys are such snobs.
Well, you know, you have to understand that for me it is such a non sequitur, because I, you know, from where I started I get enormous amounts of grief from everybody about where I went to school. So once
but this should be a safe place for you.
Well, I don't know how safe is. With you, it is. With Lisa, I think I'm going to get kicked on my way out.
but talk about this. So you're Jason.
Anyway, so he gave a lecture on asthma and drug delivery and how difficult aerosol drug delivery is for people who have asthma. And I thought to myself, well, that's not that hard. I mean, you know, you just basically figure out a way to track airflow and then spritz, you know, have an electronic finger, if you will, going, you know, to actuate the meter dose inhaler. And I sort of ran this by Drazen at the end of the lecture, and Drazen said, that's a great idea. You should go do it. And if you go do it, I'll help you. I'll be your advisor and whatnot. And that's exactly what happened, is that I started this company with my friend Reed Rubsemin, who's also a serial entrepreneur and an incredibly interesting person. He wasn't quite as smart as David, though. He only went to Stanford. and so anyway, so he and I started this company in the third floor of my townhouse in Brookline, him clomping around at 3 a.m. while my wife was trying to get sleep because we had just had our first kid, and he would raid the refrigerator, which would really annoy her. But that's a different story. So Jeff became my advisor, my thesis advisor in med school. He became an advisor to the company. And when the company went public.
What company was that?
It was called Aerodyne. And Aerodyne is still around. I mean, it's had its ups and downs. And like most of the drug delivery, aerosol drug delivery companies in particular, it's had more downs than ups. But it had a real up at one point, as did others at the time. And so it was another company. And by the way, the original backer for Aerodyne was Jack Lloyd, the founder of Nellcor.
Right. Okay.
So again, that's how the ecosystem works, right?
Sure.
If you don't piss off the people in the last company, you might get to do something again. And if you make your investors money on the last company, they might help you out on the next one.
So you've had a really interesting sort of span across healthcare, because you've been a doctor, or you're still a doctor.
Still is general practice.
Actually, my family is not sure, but...
You have the paper to prove it, though.
Right.
You've done devices.
Yes.
You've done services.
Yes.
I know you went off to that next.
I did.
And then now you're doing digital health.
Yes.
So how does, I know I'm sure we'll go into each of those companies, but what is the difference or the thread? You know, what is the experience of having it, looking at it from all different sides like that? Seeing the whole elephant.
You know, I think it's funny because the theme is really the same, which is how do you improve the connection between the doctor and your doctor,
mm-hmm.
and whether that's keeping you out of death's doorstep because the anesthesiologist is trying to asphyxiate you without oxygen, or you have heart failure and you're trying to stay out of the hospital, and you know it would be nice if your provider knew that things were happening to you before you wound up in the emergency room, mm-hmm. you know, choking to death on your own fluids. Or today, with the digital health, trying to help people keep their feet,
mm-hmm.
who have diabetes. And I think that's really been the recurring theme, is really using technology to improve the processes of care. And in the case of healthcare services, really the technology was the service. And now with digital health, I think that there's a real true opportunity for a hybrid where you've got a piece of hardware or a piece of software technology, or perhaps it's part of a smartphone that really enables you to make measurements that you couldn't possibly do otherwise, and provides a richer data set that your physician or your care provider or whoever or yourself can use to basically better manage your own health.
So why feet? Why did you get excited about feet?
You know, I don't know.
I
honestly don't have a foot fetish.
Is there more to it?
and I get enormous amounts of grief because I can tell you at Harvard Medical School, we did not concentrate much on the feet. I think what it was is that I started with Jack. And again, this is another example where 25 years later, I'm sitting in a conference room, actually in a coffee shop in Oakland, with Jack Lloyd and another guy whose name is Joe Henu, who runs a really interesting engineering services company. And we were interested in this whole problem of chronic wounds. And we originally started looking at pressure ulcers,
mm-hmm.
because that's a huge problem.
Yep.
It's a huge problem, and there was an economic penalty associated with those happening in the hospital. For a variety of reasons, we also were looking at, well, what are the other chronic wounds that people develop? We immediately honed in on diabetic foot ulcers. Why? Because diabetes is the big behemoth that is plaguing Western society and now is spilling over into India and China.
Yep.
But starting to look at it, as you know, both Jack and I were in the disease management business. I learned from him that if you want to be successful in the disease management business, you you have a piece of proprietary hardware and you get out, which he did on both counts, and with respect to the diabetic foot ulcers, that problem was actually easily as large as the heart failure problem,
mm-hmm.
and was much less well understood and much less well addressed, but yet amenable to exactly the same thing, which is these things occur over a period of time, and there's this magic window during which, if you knew what was going on, if you stuck a podiatrist in the living room and said, here, you're going to live here every day with this person, you could prevent the vast majority of these foot ulcers. And so that was a very interesting problem, because there's a huge unmet clinical need. It may be amenable to solution by a piece of technology. And if you can solve the problem, there's probably an economic model that you could construct to create a sustainable business. And so that's why the feat. And now I'm actively now sort of picking up the knowledge base, because our primary care providers for feet are not MD physicians, but are DPM podiatry physicians.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they are a critical part of the care team, and they're actually the most important member for foot care, especially for people with diabetes. And so we're looking at this, is there a way to actually create a much closer, a digital health solution that actually fits in the world of podiatry?
Hmm. And it's interesting, I mean, you really have this tradition of being able to kind of provide technology to empower not only necessarily physicians, but some other providers. You know, people always talk about practicing at the top of their license, but it almost, you improve the performance maybe or the capabilities. One of the companies I know that you've been involved with was actually started by the way, another of our anatomy partners.
Good Lord.
Uh-huh. Right, Shai Ghazani, who developed this company called Neurometrics. Do you want to explain a little bit about that?
So Neurometrics is an incredibly innovative company. And they started life, actually, Neurometrics actually started life with Shai trying to measure blood glucose non-invasively using nerve physiology, you know, changes in the nerve conduction pattern. And he realized that that wasn't going to happen.
Too hard, yeah.
That was too hard. And along the way, he came up with this really great technology to measure nerve conduction and nerve physiology. And he created this powerful, easy-to-use solution that a primary care practice could use to do most basic nerve conduction tests, which until Neurometrics were only really done by specialists, neurologists and physiatrists. And so
essentially their only procedure.
And essentially their only major procedure. And Neurometrics was very successful both clinically. The early data was very powerful and very exciting that the device would capture information, be processed by their computer system, return to the physician, giving them the tool to quickly diagnose common problems like carpal tunnel syndrome and peripheral neuropathies of all kind of many different kinds.
And so how did that go over with the neurologist who had previously made a living conducting the nerve conduction studies?
Well, it kind of went like, there's something like a blanket of spacesuit or a... it didn't go over well. And I think that, you know, the problem with disruption is twofold. You know, there's the law of unintended consequences. So partly what happened was primary care physicians suddenly had access to a piece of technology that could enable them to bill.
Create a billable procedure.
To create a billable procedure that was orders of magnitude higher than anything they had in their practices.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that potentially created a conflict for these practices. On the other hand, it was potentially siphoning off procedures from these specialists.
Somebody's revenue, somebody's equals somebody's cost.
And, you know, it's the old, you know, whose ox did you gore?
Yeah, exactly.
And that created a lot of unintended consequences. It almost wound up costing the company its viability.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, Neurometrics has recovered, and Shai has taken the company has turned it into a digital therapeutics company, and they have now a fabulous OTC pain management device. So it was almost, and again, in the world of technology, right, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
So what do you do for fun? I mean, you've started, what, like six companies, you know, how do you burn off that energy? Is there any other way?
Well, let's see. When my kids were younger, I was doing a lot of backpacking. So all three of my sons are Eagle Scouts. Uh-huh. So I do a lot with the Boy Scouts, and I still do.
Why don't you get to the real thing, Dave?
Made my Harley. I actually sold. My wife made me sell the Harley, but I just got another one.
Did you get rid of the wife? Or
no, I can't get rid of. No, I'm actually going on 25 years with the same wife.
But different motorcycle.
Different motorcycle. So
where do you ride your motorcycle? So
I've ridden it everywhere.
Do you leather up?
He's definitively not a VC.
You leather up and drive out past Fairfax, up over the hill?
I am leathered up. I'm virtually certain that I have the only motorcycle that I've ever seen that has a Harvard Medical School decal on the windshield. And I do it for two reasons. One is
irony.
That it's irony. And the other is I'm hoping that if I ever get stopped, not that I am absolutely given the inherent risk, I'm a very safe rider, but if I ever get stopped by the police, I'm hoping that they will cut me a break.
Well, Lisa wouldn't let me play. I had like multiple clips from Wild Hogs all ready to go. I got vetoed.
Yeah, but, I will tell you that there's what is it, Harley? There's
Wait, Dave, what the fuck are you thinking anyway with the motorcycle? Like your doctor this, careful that, cautious this, and then the motorcycle. How does that figure?
Well, you know what it is? It's about managing risk. It's about focus. And
convincing oneself of anything.
Well, convincing that you can, you know, that you can manage risk and do things that are, you know, that have
annoying
an element
to your wife.
That are that have an element of risk and require incredible focus. I mean, one of the other things that I've done is I've actually become recently designated as an aviation medical examiner for FAA.
Oh, wow.
And I'm planning to use that as an excuse to, at age 50 something plenty, to actually learn how to fly.
Really?
And the reason is exactly the same, which is I am
can't
inherently
get enough of a rush off the motorcycle.
Well, it's anything that has technology and a little bit of risk is really interesting to me. So skiing, bicycling, motorcycles.
Sounds
planes,
like surgery.
Well, on which side of the knife?
Sounds like both.
Yeah.
All righty. Well, we could go on forever. We'll have to have you back. Incredibly great to reconnect, to talk about some small fraction of all the things that you've done. And we're so grateful you're able to join us today for this episode.
Thanks for having me. It's great to see you, and you don't smell like formaldehyde.
I hope you're talking to David
you.
And not to me.
I am. I was looking at him. And thank you for the opportunity.
Nice to see you, David.
Nice to see you.
Pleasure.